Before we start today's show, we just wanted to share some exciting news with you all. We've launched our own Patreon page. Your donations will help with costs of producing and bringing you a show with better content such as on-site visits to prisons, prison phone calls, interviews, and much, much more. For only $6, you get a pros and cons sticker and pin, a Patreon exclusive episode every month. This could be a Q&A, interview with a special guest, update to a previous case, and a shout out on our social media and your name added to our website as a contributor. It also includes access to our private Slack group where you can get behind the scene updates like upcoming episodes, inmate artwork sent to Bethany, and then you can just chat with us and other listeners. Head on over to www.patreon.com/mouthoffnetwork and select the pros and cons tier to become a patron today.
Obviously, it's this amazing case that's been solved. It's one of the first of its kind. So just take me back to your introduction to the case and really what your genesis was with being involved with the case.
True crime and unsolved serial murder cases had been a transient interest of mine throughout adulthood. I think this particular case came to my attention 2006 or 2007, I had seen a rebroadcast of an MSNBC special. But it was produced before the Southern California cases were linked to the Easter Rapist series. So it covered exclusively those cases. It was also during a lull in my true crime kick. So kind of drifted to the back of my mind for a while. But then it just bubbled up like a year later. And I remember going to Google and trying to find the case based on what I remembered. And that's when I learned the full scope of it, which encompassed this series of burglaries in Visalia and this massive series of rapes in Northern California.
One of the problems was branding him, you know, and can you just speak to that and about how instrumental Michelle was in kind of pulling all the names together and finding one moniker to put him under?
Sure. Yeah, this serial offender is unique in that he had like five or six different like monikers. Zodiac Killer is just the Zodiac Killer. Yeah. Green River Killer is just the Green River Killer. Yeah. But this offender was known as the East Area Rapist, the original Night Stalker, the Irons, the Creek Killer, the Diamond Knot Killer. None of which are particularly memorable. And well, yeah, the Visalia Ransacker. That was the. I mean, we didn't know for sure that it was the same offender, but yes. And so, the cul-de-sac killer was another one. This is a case that flew under the radar, and we didn't quite understand why, but we suspected that branding was one of the issues that sort of needed to be resolved in order to bring this case to a broader level of awareness. And so Michelle didn't come up with the name Golden State Killer. I don't remember who did, but she sort of put out a petition to her social circle, and there were like 50 different candidates. My favorite was Silent but Deadly, but that ultimately is not what was chosen. But Golden State Killer, generic though it might sound, is a lot more memorable than Irons.
Irons. It's like ear. Is your ear on?
Yeah.
Oh. If there's a blind serial killer, they're in trouble. I would say. So you're a filmmaker and producer and director by nature, and this has always kind of just been a personal passion of yours. So can you talk to me a little bit about any pop culture or film references that have come up through the years or that you might foresee happening in the future, such as like a Hannibal Lecter reference, or do you foresee him kind of cementing himself in the same way other serial killers have, or, you know, just from your own kind of as a director, what do you think is going to happen there?
I mean, you know, from a filmmaking standpoint, I think this would be a difficult story to tell in like a traditional 2-hour narrative. You know, the scope of it is so broad. And how many of you have read Larry Crompton's book, Sudden Terror? Anybody? Nobody? Zero? So Larry Crompton, he's a retired investigator who led the EAR task force in Contra Costa County. And he wrote, he self-published a book called Sudden Terror in 2010. Which is a great case resource, but not very good literature. And the problem with the book is that it essentially just repackages all of the cases. And so it's just the same sequence of events over and over and over again, because this is the rapist's MO, and he victimized upwards of like 70 people. So obviously you wouldn't depict 70 attacks. It certainly is a way to tell the story, but I don't know that I'm interested in telling it from a narrative standpoint. My interest in cinema and my interest in true crime are very separate. There's real passion, I think, behind my interest in cinema. There's no real passion to my interest in true crime. It's obsession that's sort of devoid of passion. It's kind of like, you know, if you do a puzzle or a crossword, there's no passion, but you can spend the whole... there are people that could spend a whole day just doing crossword puzzles, you know? So I don't know. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, just like there are people who spend the day doing a crossword puzzle, there are people who spend their lives chasing a particular case. Do you find yourself gravitating towards a new case now?
Yeah, there are other cases that interest me, but I think that the new landscape is that of forensic genealogy, which kind of eliminates a lot of the traditional sleuthing that appeals to me. You know, if you have the offender's DNA, it's just as simple as, at this point, uploading that DNA profile into a public genealogical database, and it's like a magical planchette that just points you directly toward the offender. And in many cases that have been resolved over the last year, in most of the cases that have been resolved via forensic genealogy, and there's been approaching 50 by this point, the perpetrators were never suspects. They were never on police radar. So you don't need a suspect now. I mean, the great thing about DNA is that that's a way to eliminate to rule out or rule in a suspect, but now you don't need a suspect pool. You know, Michelle and I, in the months before she died, we had gone to Orange County and left with this huge cache of case files. I mean, in this landscape, that kind of thing would be redundant. You wouldn't need any of that information. You would only need a DNA profile.
So my producing partner's here. She worked on Unmasking a Killer. One of the things we talked about, because I'd worked on that lightly as well, was, you know, kind of a difference of approach. Are you making a TV series? Are you helping to solve a case? So obviously now all of that's been done. TV shows have been made and, you know, the case has been solved. What role do you think the media played, and especially because after this lull of years and it kind of went under the radar, what role do you think the media played in reigniting an interest in the case and bringing it back to life?
So yes, I do represent Michelle, and I'm a little partial, but you know, this case had been profiled on Unsolved Mysteries, on Cold Case Files, E! Investigates, so there had not been a dearth of coverage. It just never really stuck. And I think it was really Michelle's death that was a huge story. She was the wife of Patton Oswalt, and she was also synonymous with this unsolved serial murder case. And so I think that is what brought the case to a level of awareness that it previously eluded it. And within months, the FBI had posted a reward. They were putting resources into the investigation. You know, with any cold case, you can have passionate investigators that want to see it solved, but without resources and funding, I mean, it's an uphill battle. And those resources and funding materialize in the months after Michelle died. So I think that Michelle's involvement with the case was like a significant factor in it being closed. I think it would have been closed eventually. I think that forensic genealogy really, I hate the phrase game changer, but you know, I don't want to just sit here in silence reaching for a better phrase. It really is a game changer, and it was inevitable that this day would come, but Golden State Killer was the case that facilitated it.
Why do you think there was a sudden resurgence of interest, you know, by the Bureau? Because they did do that big press conference. You know, do you think it's strictly because they were coming up to an anniversary? Do you think that there was an impetus with kind of testing this genealogical DNA? Like, what's your perspective and what's your take on that?
I think the genealogical approach was sort of being done by Paul Holes and Erica Hutchcraft kind of behind the scenes under the radar. I don't know that the FBI had a lot to do with that. The FBI posted a reward. I think the FBI had like assigned investigators in different jurisdictions to focus on the case full time. But I really think it was the level of attention that the case was receiving that kind of like lit a fire under the asses of the FBI and their Sacramento and Orange County, that they began taking this case seriously. Because that's the problem with cold cases, is that they're cold cases. There's limited funding municipally. And of course, they're going to focus on fresher cases. But this was a case whose scope was so broad. And, you know, it's like the victim type as well. You know, historically, cases where the victims have been like underprivileged or like prostitutes, those cases have received less attention. This has not been a case like that. These cases were like upper middle class people targeted in their homes. So it really was puzzling to everyone who really cared about this case that it had, you know, completely escaped public awareness.
So talk to me a little bit about your creative process working with Michelle, writing the book, and, you know, kind of how you have the before, you know, the pre-arrest and then post-arrest, and what that creative lifestyle looked like for you.
Well, Michelle was the author of the book. I was her investigative partner. So I did like data mining and stuff, you know, compilations of information. It wasn't until after Michelle passed that the book was left unfinished. And I was retained by Patton, and then Billy Jensen was brought on board to help. And there were, you know, large swaths of the case that had not been covered by her. So, you know, I wrote those segments that Michelle didn't get around to writing. Those were sort of presented as editor's notes. You know, I wrote the footnotes and the image captions, and I essentially co-edited the book. But, you know, it was important for everybody that the book be finished and released. Yeah, I don't know. There was no real structure to any of it. And I think a lot of us, we were just waiting for kind of Patton to be ready to engage because it's a devastating loss for him. And I think it was just difficult for him all along to completely engage. And he kind of just left it to me and to Billy and to HarperCollins.
Well, it's a case that's well known. Are you open to opening it up to the audience to ask some questions about your work?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, not a lot of information has been publicly released over the last year about Joseph DeAngelo. I think most of the information that's out there is kind of came out in the first few months. I think one of the issues is that he's not really talking. He's not cooperating. The other issue is that because this case was so closely linked with Michelle and other media entities, I think now there's this kind of political proprietary attitude in every jurisdiction to take possession of the case and not cooperate and release information as they build their case, primarily Sacramento, but I think it's a collaborative effort among all the jurisdictions. So that noise didn't come from me. But yeah, I mean, I think, have you been following the case? I think that's the latest big development, yeah. What frustrates me is that we haven't seen pictures of him during that period. We've seen one picture of him during that 76 to 79 period of him, like the Little League picture. It's not a very good picture. And I'm really curious, like, how his appearance compares to the many composites associated with this case, because there's at least 40 composites associated with this case. It's unprecedented. I don't know of any other case with so many composites.
Do you know Michael Street, the forensic sketch pot? Because I want to get his perspective.
Tom.
Michael Street.
I don't know.
Michael Street's a forensic sketch artist, and he's, you know, very well respected in multiple jurisdictions. And I've always wanted to ask him that question about what you're talking about right now, about the different composites. So can you talk to that a little bit more?
There are so many variables where composite sketches are concerned. You know, you have to look at the circumstances that yielded the composite sketch. You have to consider the reliability of the witness, you know, how the sketch was created. In this case, most of those composite sketches were of suspicious individuals seen in the neighborhoods around the time of each attack. So, you know, D'Angelo was wearing a mask in pretty much every attack. With the exception of number 15, he was wearing something where his face was exposed. And there was a composite that was created from the victim's description of him. But, you know, it's just really a matter of... you know, looking at the circumstances and determining the likelihood of that person having been D'Angelo or having just been somebody incidentally in the neighborhoods. Composite sketches are not a great investigative tool. It's just something that, you know, it's something visual. And I think people like things that are visual. The first composite sketch, I think it was released in this case, was an artist's conception. And it was ultimately more toxic than helpful because it opened the floodgates and there was like a secret, I think they called it a secret witness, so people could call in tips anonymously. And they just had thousands of tips on the basis of that artist conception, which I think were the artist conception was like a composite of the like blonde hair, square face. It was not based on any one particular, yeah, the surfer dude sketch. It wasn't based on any one physical description. It was useless, essentially.
Okay.
He was, I think, 40 at the time of the last General Cruz's murder. These offenders do slow down. I think it's, you know, it's libido, it's physical ability, it's lifestyle factors that result in them kind of retiring. I think the wisdom for a long time was that these offenders can't stop, but that's not the case. And we've seen that with BTK and Gary Ridgway. Ridgway was still murdering people, but at a pace of like one every 5 or 6 years at the time that he was caught. BTK Dennis Rader hadn't murdered anyone, I think, since like 91. So it was like a 15-year period of inactivity. I don't know. It's possible there might be one or two more. I think that it's more likely there are undetected burglary series that preceded the rapes than there are undetected murders. anyone else?
What does it mean to the victims to finally have this face of the name? You know, you've lived with this story longer than pretty much anyone besides law enforcement. So you've seen them, you've seen it ebb, you've seen it flow, you've seen it popular, not popular. What does it mean to the victims?
Well, I think it's a relief. I think it's a relief to put a name and a face to the specter of the person that attacked these people. You know, even as like a true crime consumer, when these offenders are identified, it almost completely robs them of their power. You know, D'Angelo, Gary Ridgway, Dennis Rader, none of them look particularly intimidating or frightening. In fact, they're kind of bland, shallow, vapid people. Actually seeing that, I think... if I were a victim, I would sleep a lot better at night knowing that this person's no longer out there. Because he was somebody that, you know, as I'm sure many of you know, would phone victims after having attacked them. He would remain in their lives. And now that he's behind bars and 73 years old and, you know, he's never going to be you know, outside of a jail cell ever again. So, and it's vindicating, obviously. At Nashville last year? Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And yeah, I think they just, they created a website. They call themselves the Sister Survivors. So now they have their own website. It's like nicely professionally designed. And I mean, it's you know, it's great that they're kind of taking back the power from this person who now, yeah. Yeah, I don't think we know yet when it's going to go to trial. There's a hearing on April 10th, and this will be, and I'll be attending that hearing. This will be my first time seeing D'Angelo in person. You know, this could. The legal proceedings could drag on for another 5 or 6 years, yeah, particularly given the number of cases. It'd be just so much easier if he accepts a plea deal or something. But with the death penalty off the table now, because I don't know if you, I'm sure you all know, the death penalty has been, there's a moratorium. You know, it's harder to strike plea deals. That I don't, I'm anti-capital punishment, death penalty, but I think the one value of it is that it's like a bargaining chip you can use to get information from people that otherwise, you know, like Gary Ridgway, Dennis Rader, Roger Kibbe, the I-5 Strangler, all of them agreed to tell all and resolve all the unanswered questions associated with their crime series if the death penalty were taken off the table. So that's its value. The Governor Gavin Newsom has a, yeah, right, yeah. Oh, there are people up there. Hi. Any questions up there? I think they're okay.
What would you say to him if you could talk to, what would you say to D'Angelo if you could talk to him?
I mean, I have questions. I have a whole like document of like unanswered questions. I don't think he would answer them, but I would, why not? He's just not talking. I don't think there's any motivation for him to speak. I think that he, a lot of serial offenders are compartmentalized, and there's a dissociative process where they kind of, I don't think he wants to acknowledge that he did these things. So I don't know. Right. Mm. And you resumed it? Yeah. Yeah. How many people here read the book before he was caught? I mean, it's great because you had this immediate real life epilogue. That was the best time to read it. Unless, of course, in your case, you were too scared. I mean, there were just so many theories about what he may have done for a living. Paul Holes, you know, who, bless his heart, is responsible for the case being solved. And I love Paul. He's really smart. He's a great guy. But, you know, he felt that this would be somebody who's like a contractor with like a private plane. He did not think that the Visalia ransacker and the Easter rapist were the same offender. And neither did I at the end. So we were both wrong about that. You know, there were theories that he worked in the medical field, the health industry, that he would be like a low life with, a long rap sheet. I didn't think so. I think he would have been identified if that were the case. I mean, a lot of people thought he was dead. There were people that thought there were multiple offenders, that he had an accomplice. Which I think is very unlikely. Usually in cases where there are accomplices, those cases are solved because people can't keep their mouths shut. It's very rare. And in instances where that's the case, usually they're caught very quickly. I don't know. There are just so many theories associated with this case that, you know, at this point, they've just kind of faded from my mind. Because I had a specific image in mind of who this person would be. And D'Angelo doesn't really fit. So it's kind of like I'm being acquainted with this case all over again. It's a weird feeling. Right. The weird feeling of disappointment, yeah. Ken Clark is the investigator in Sacramento that he's kind of camera and media shy, so I don't know that we're going to hear much from him, which is unfortunate because he's a great storyteller. I love Ken Clark. I hope that once he retires, he changes his mind. But he was telling me after he was caught, he was likening it to when he was a kid. All of his friends had Rubik's Cubes, and he envied them. And he would just watch them figuring out the Rubik's Cube within like a number of hours. And it was just such a triumphant feeling that he wanted to have. And so he finally got a Rubik's Cube, and it took him like days to finally figure it out. And once he did, he put it on a shelf and it just sat there, and he described it as like this piece of shit on a shelf that I completely lost interest in. And he kind of felt this, he feels the same deflated feeling with D'Angelo having been identified. I don't feel that, but D'Angelo's face is not what I envisioned. I don't know. I think that for me, I'm always sort of, I have my antenna. I was trying to think of something, like a synonym, because describing one as having antennae is repulsive. But I'm particularly interested in what things evoke. And, you know, even with like true crime, I like being scared. I like being spooked. And so this case evoked a different person, if that makes sense to you. And seeing D'Angelo's face, kind of looks like Uncle Fester. Well, yeah, he has like a Band-Aid on his head. And from what I was told, after he was arrested, he began ramming his head into the wall of the holding cell. That's why his head was cut. I haven't seen this published anywhere.
You do see that a lot with inmates, and then they try to say, oh, well, it was like police brutality, or it was this, or it was that. And it's like, no, the CCTV has you smashing your face into the wall. And maybe it was like a bizarre suicide attempt. Maybe
he was put on suicide watch. And he was also, in his first court appearance, he was handcuffed to a wheelchair. And people were like, oh, he's trying to, you know, play the frail old man. But no, he was actually sedated. And that was a way that they could control him. Because he had attempted to bash his head in.
Grab one of the guards' guns, or
you don't know what someone like that's gonna do. So, yeah, putting him in a wheelchair, handcuffed, is pretty secure. Yeah. Oh my God, I have a cheat document actually. It'll take me a minute to find it. Oh, here we go. You want to just read them off? Did you drop the homework evidence? I don't think you did. Did you make any of the phone calls? Did you kill the Majoris? He was charged with those murders, and I just never really thought they were connected. What was your connection to each of the places in Southern California you offended? Did you opt out of any public records databases? Were there any rapes attributed to you that you were not responsible for? Did you write the poem, the Excitement's Crave poem? Where are the items that you stole? I think that might be my number one question, actually. I don't think they found anything, as far as I know. But we haven't heard anything in months, so it's anyone's guess. What drew you to Nigel Shores? That's where the Harringtons lived. That was a gated community. Very unlikely choice. And also, what drew him to the first? I think it was the first Davis victim who lived in student housing. So those. It's just a handful of questions I'd like to see resolved. Try to fit my gigantic phone back in my pocket. Okay. I honestly don't know. I'm not optimistic. I'd like him to talk. I think we'd all like him to talk, but I don't think so. What are your other questions? Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Right.
So I guess I'm wondering, of all the people that you and Michelle investigated, you personally, did you have one specific person in mind that you just, like, were convinced?
I never did. I had people that I felt strongly about, but then invariably I would find information about them that kind of pointed away from them. I had one guy that lived literally everywhere that has been linked to this case. He's from Visalia. He lived in Sacramento, Concord, Laguna Niguel, Santa Barbara, Ventura. But he's like 6'2", I found out. And he was living in Sacramento in the mid-80s. But that person was my favorite. Never on the radar. No, I think the closest Michelle may have gotten to D'Angelo is what she would do is she would upload every now and then like the DNA marker she did have to like public genealogical databases like YSearch, which are not as specific as GEDmatch. YSearch would give you possible surnames. And typically the surnames would be like British, maybe with Germanic influence. But then there was one subset that were, they were, their origin was the Azores, which is a group of islands off the coast of Portugal. One surname was De Silva and another one was Angelo, which is similar to D'Angelo. I don't know what the connection is, but that's, I think, the closest she may have gotten. Sure. Oh, do I share the privacy concerns that are being written about now? I was talking to a friend the other day about how, well, you were there. My friend Megan. And she was talking about how she was having a conversation with her friend about how she'd gained a few pounds. And then next thing she knew, Instagram was showing her like weight loss ads. The founder of MoviePass has this new service where you get free movie tickets if you watch like a 15 to 20 minute ad on your phone. And he wants to implement Apple's camera technology to ensure that you watch the entirety of the ad. That's a lot creepier to me than I upload my DNA to a public database and it helps solve like a serial murder case. I've uploaded my DNA to GEDmatch. If it helps solve it, look, I mean, like people are like, well, I'm not my father. Well, I'm not my third cousin. So if my third cousin happens to be a serial murderer, well, great. I think we should know about that. I don't think he. I think he was really discreet. He never offended in the places he lived. I don't think he would have been dumb enough to show up at the town hall meeting in the 70s. Yeah. So I'm sure you all know the story about the couple that attended this town hall meeting, and the husband spoke up and was belligerent with the cops, and then 8 months later, he and his wife were targeted. I think it's just pure coincidence based on the neighborhood in which they lived. I'm sorry? Water cooler talk? Yeah, well, that's a possibility. Yeah, yeah, but he was a cop. He was a cop in Auburn, and that's what was really surprising to me. He wasn't a resident of Sacramento County. He had relatives that lived in the buffer zones that were of interest to me, and that Kim Rossmo identified. His in-laws, Bonnie, his ex-fiance, lived right there. Right there, Kim Rossmo's Ground Zero was like literally a block away from where Bonnie lived. But he was living in Auburn pretty much the entire time. So I don't know that he would have had much interaction with Sacramento authorities.
Was D'Angelo's name ever on the kid's list?
I'm the kid.
Yeah, sorry.
No, and he never would have made it on the list. I never would have found him. Never would have found him. He was never on anybody's radar. Yes.
Yeah.
throwing motorcycle parts around, like this motorcycle he loves so much. So does that fit with anything that you may or may not have learned about D'Angelo not being able to do this? Like, he's got a lot of temper.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I haven't heard that story, actually, but a lot of his neighbors and people that have known him throughout his life describe him similarly. He's someone who would just fly into a rage over seemingly trivial things, which sounds like that was a trivial thing. And a lot of serial offenders are, you know, they do, they wear this mask of sanity, but every now and then it slips. And D'Angelo is no exception in that respect. Crickets. Yeah. Geographic profiling. No, it doesn't. It doesn't fit. All of the geographic profiles, and I mean, there weren't very many. There was one done by Kim Rossmo and one done by, I think his name was Neil Godwin. But he didn't even live in Sacramento. He lived in the next county, in Placer County, in the town of Auburn. So, no, I mean, all of the tenets of geographic profiling, I mean, they didn't apply in this case. Occam's razor just didn't apply in this case.
Mm-hmm.
The WGA Theater. Yeah, Live Talks LA. Not until after he was caught, thank goodness. Yeah. No. I remember we were at the Skylight Books when we did My Favorite Murder for the first time, and a friend of mine was there, and she was eyeing a guy that was standing like kind of discreetly in the back, who was like an older dude, and she's like, I think maybe that's it. But I don't think it was D'Angelo. Yeah. From what I gather, D'Angelo was so paranoid in the last few years before his arrest that I think he wouldn't have imagined doing something like that, showing up at an event like that. You mean after her death? Yeah, I mean, it had already become that for me. I think for me, though, I didn't have a husband or a wife. I didn't have a kid. I didn't have the responsibilities and life structure that she had, so it was a lot less disruptive for me. I mean, Michelle seemed to balance all those things so well, but you know, in hindsight, maybe she wasn't able to. But certainly it was definitely an obsession for me, and I'm glad that the case has been resolved so I can kind of start moving on with my life. Was there a question? Well, I think it's just because the case reached a broader level of media saturation, and also the stories, the anecdotes we have are, you know, they apply to the last few years of his life. But I know that he called the phone company and wanted his phone disabled because he thought somebody was listening in on his calls. Yeah. And I think the day he was arrested or the week leading up to it, when it was being surveilled, he seemed to have some awareness that he was being surveilled based on his movements. I think you had a question. Yeah, it was a particular case. I think I had been interested in like Unsolved Mysteries since I was a kid, when I literally watched the show Unsolved Mysteries. But I was like more into aliens and ghosts at that age. But when I was 18, I had a lot of like cyber friends, a lot of AOL friends. This was the late 90s after all. And my dad gave me a warning about, you know, be careful who you're connecting with, because there's this guy that was just arrested who was like luring women in chat rooms and murdering them. And it was John Edward Robinson. And he was just this like pillar of the community who presented himself as a successful businessman while also luring women to Kansas and murdering them and then putting their bodies in like barrels that he stored on his property. So I was just fascinated by the contrast between how he presented himself and the fact that he was a serial murderer. And that's a running theme in the kind of annals of serial murder. These are people that they wear a mask. They're highly compartmentalized. And I think it's the kind of surface normalcy and how it contrasts with what's actually going on that really fascinates me. What was your case? Oh, Kuklinski, yeah, mafia hitman. Yeah. 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 I remember learning about John Wayne Gacy when I was like 9 or 10. There was a TV movie with Brian Dennehy called To Catch a Killer. Has anyone seen that? Brian Dennehy plays Gacy, and he's scarier than Gacy himself. And I remember having nightmares about Gacy chasing me. But Brian Dennehy as Gacy. Brian Dennehy for a while was claiming that he was a Vietnam vet, and then he was like outed as a fraud, and he was like, yeah, okay, I lied about it. But then he continued lying about it. Yeah. The next murder I would like, well, Zodiac, obviously. Do you have information? Do you know who the Zodiac is? I'm interested in the Freeway Phantom case. I think there's a good idea of who the Freeway Phantom was. There's just not been any movement. So that's curious to me. And then there's the Connecticut River Valley Killer. And in that case, I don't think there is any DNA. So that might be an unsolvable case. I think Zodiac might be unsolvable. Unless you know otherwise. I just saw that look you gave me. I think, okay. Well, suddenly I feel a surge of optimism.
You should.
Yeah. All right.
Feel optimistic.
I'm feeling optimistic.
There we go.
This is exciting.
Well, I know when we first connected professionally, we talked about the roast quote that D'Angelo.
Oh, yeah. You all know about this, right?
Yeah.
When D'Angelo was arrested, police came to his door, and he came out, and they cuffed him. He was like, I'm sure it did. I hope it's in, like, a museum or something. Like, the Museum of Death. Anyone ever been to the Museum of Death? They should have the roast.
They should.
Yeah.
So, one last thing, and then we'll let you get back to your drinking and true criming. Your beer is warm. We'll get you a fresh one. So he likes IPAs. So in conclusion, so the day that he was actually caught, oddly enough, because I'd worked lightly on unmasking a killer, a bunch of inmates who I'd interviewed for, you know, the true crime docs I'd done had called to say, and one of them called with really specific information. I thought you might like this, so that you can tell him, you can regale this to him on April 10th to D'Angelo. Okay. And they said, and I quote, "You better be put in the protective housing unit, because when your ass comes to my cell block, you're not lasting long."
I like that.
Yeah, and so they were like, "Bethany, he's been caught." And I was like, okay, all right, hold on. Let me put you on with Paul Haynes, and you can give him the information. So we're very excited that you're here and that you're part of our true crime community. And please keep us apprised of all the movements on the case, on the page, and just come back anytime.
Thanks so much. Thanks for coming out.
Be
Before we sign off, I just wanted to tell you about a new podcast I'm executive producing called The Intersection of Cancer and Life. It is hosted by my dear friend, Emily Garnett, who was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer in November 2017. Emily and her guests discuss the changes, challenges, and unexpected shifts that have occurred while living with cancer. These conversations emphasize the fact that there is no one-size-fits-all approach to rebuilding a life after diagnosis, and lets listeners know that they are not alone, whether they themselves have been diagnosed with cancer or have a friend or loved one navigating treatment. You can listen to the first season now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and your favorite podcast app by searching for The Intersection of Cancer and Life.